So they went exploring, Jojen Reed leading, Bran in his basket on Hodor's back, Summer padding by their side. Once the direwolf bolted through a dark door and returned a moment later with a grey rat between his teeth. The rat cook, Bran thought, but it was the wrong colour, and only as big as a cat. The rat cook was white and almost as huge as a sow. There were a lot of dark doors in the night fort, and a lot of rats. Bran could hear them scurrying through the vaults and cellars and the maze of pitch-black tunnels that connected them. Jojen wanted to go poking around down there, but Hodor said, "Hodor!" to that, and Bran said, "No." There were worse things than rats down in the dark beneath Nightfort. "This seems an old place," Jojen said, as they walked down a gallery where the sunlight fell in dusty shafts through empty windows. "Twice as old as Castle Black," Bran said, remembering. "It was the first castle on the wall and the largest. But it also had been the first abandoned, all the way back in the time of the Old King. Even then it had been three-quarters empty and too costly to maintain. Good Queen Alysanne had suggested that the Watch replace it with a smaller, newer castle, at a spot only 7 miles east, where the wall curved along the shore of a beautiful green lake. Deep Lake had been paid for by the Queen's jewels, and built by the men the Old King had sent north, and the Black Brothers had abandoned the Night Fort to the rats. That was 2 centuries past, though. Now Deep Lake stood as empty as the castle it had replaced, and the Night Fort. "There are ghosts here," Bran said. Hodor had heard all the stories before, but Jojen might not have. "Old ghosts, from before the Old King, even before Aegon the Dragon. 79 deserters who went south to be outlaws. One was Lord Rizewell's youngest son, so when they reached the Barrowlands, they sought shelter at his castle. But Lord Rizewell took them captive and returned them to the Night Fort. The Lord Commander had holes hewn in the top of the wall, and he put the deserters in them and sealed them up alive in the ice. They have spears and horns, and they all face north. The 79 sentinels, they're called. They left their posts in life, so in death their watch goes on forever. Years later, when Lord Rizewell was old and dying, he had himself carried to the Night Fort so he could take the Black and stand beside his son. He'd sent him back to the wall for honour's sake, but he loved him still, so he came to share his watch." They spent half the day poking through the castle. Some of the towers had fallen down, and others looked unsafe, but they climbed the bell tower. The bells were gone, and the rookery, the birds were gone. Beneath the brewhouse they found a vault of huge oaken casks that boomed hollowly when Hodor knocked on them. They found a library. The shelves and bins had collapsed, the books were gone, and rats were everywhere. They found a dank and dim-lit dungeon with cells enough to hold 500 captives, but when Bran grabbed hold of one of the rusted bars, it broke off in his hand. Only one crumbling wall remained of the great hall. The bathhouse seemed to be sinking into the ground, and a huge thorn bush had conquered the practice yard outside the armory where Black Brothers had once labored with spear and shield and sword. The armory and the forge still stood, however, though cobwebs, rats, and dust had taken the places of blades, bellows, and anvil. Sometimes Summer would hear sounds that Bran seemed deaf to, or bare his teeth at nothing, the fur on the back of his neck bristling. But the rat cook never put in an appearance, nor the 79 sentinels, nor Mad Axe. Bran was much relieved. "Maybe it is only a ruined empty castle." By the time Mira returned, the sun was only a sword's breadth above the western hills. "What did you see?" her brother Jojen asked her.
"I saw the haunted forest," she said in a wistful tone.
hills rising wild as far as the eye can see, covered with trees that no axe has ever touched. I saw the sunlight glinting off a lake, and clouds sweeping in from the west. I saw patches of old snow and icicles long as pikes. I even saw an eagle circling. I think he saw me too. I waved at him.
"Did you see a way down?" asked Jojen.
She shook her head.
"No, it's a sheer drop, and the ice is so smooth. I might be able to make the descent if I had a good rope and an axe to chop out handholds, but..."
"But not us," Jojen finished.
"No," his sister agreed. "Are you sure this is the place you saw in your dream? Maybe we have the wrong castle."
"No, this is the castle. There is a gate here."
"Yes," thought Bran, "but it's blocked by stone and ice."
As the sun began to set, the shadows of the towers lengthened, and the wind blew harder, sending gusts of dry, dead leaves rattling through the yards. The gathering gloom put Bran in mind of another of old Nan's stories, the tale of Night's King. He had been the 13th man to lead the Night's Watch, she said, a warrior who knew no fear.
"And that was the fault in him," she would add, "for all men must know fear."
A woman was his downfall. A woman glimpsed from atop the wall, with skin as white as the moon and eyes like blue stars. Fearing nothing, he chased her, and caught her, and loved her, though her skin was cold as ice. And when he gave his seed to her, he gave his soul as well. He brought her back to the Night Fort, and proclaimed her a queen and himself her king, and with strange sorceries he bound his sworn brothers to his will. For 13 years they had ruled, Night's King and his corpse queen, till finally the Stark of Winterfell and Joramund of the Wildlings had joined to free the Watch from bondage. After his fall, when it was found he had been sacrificing to the others, all records of Night's King had been destroyed, his very name forbidden.
"Some say he was a Bolton," old Nan would always end. "Some say a Magnar out of Skagos. Some say Umber, Flint, or Nurry. Some would have you think he was a Woodfoot from them who ruled Bear Island before the Iron Men came. He never was. He was a Stark, the brother of the man who brought him down."
She always pinched Bran on the nose then. He would never forget it.
"He was a Stark of Winterfell, and who could say, mayhaps his name was Brandon. Mayhaps he slept in this very bed, in this very room."
"No," Bran thought, "but he walked in this castle where we'll sleep tonight."
He did not like that notion very much at all. Night's King was only a man by light of day, old Nan would always say, but the night was his to rule.
"And it's getting dark."
The Reeds decided that they would sleep in the kitchens, a stone octagon with a broken dome. It looked to offer better shelter than most of the other buildings, even though a crooked weirwood had burst up through the slate floor beside the huge central well, stretching slantwise towards the hole in the roof, its bone-white branches reaching for the sun. It was a queer kind of tree, skinnier than any other weirwood that Bran had ever seen, and faceless as well. But it made him feel as if the old guards were with him here, at least. That was the only thing he liked about the kitchens, though. The roof was mostly there, so they'd be dry if it rained again, but he didn't think they would ever get warm here. You could feel the cold seeping up through the slate floor. Bran did not like the shadows either, or the huge brick ovens that surrounded them like open mouths, or the rusted meat hooks, or the scars and stains he saw in the butcher's block along one wall.
That was where the rat cook chopped the prince to pieces,
he knew,
and he baked the pie in one of these ovens.
The well was the thing he liked the least, though. It was a good 12 feet across, all stone, with steps built into its side, circling down and down into darkness. The walls were damp and covered with nitre, but none of them could see the water at the bottom, not even Mira, with her sharp hunter's eyes.
"Maybe it doesn't have a bottom," Bran said uncertainly.
Hodor peered over the knee-high lip of the well and said, "Hodor!" The words echoed down the well. "Hodor! Hodor! Hodor!" Fainter and fainter. "Hodor! Hodor! Hodor!" Until it was less than a whisper. Hodor looked startled. Then he laughed and bent to scoop a broken piece of slate off the floor.
"Hodor, don't!"
said Bran, but too late. Hodor tossed the slate over the edge.
"You shouldn't have done that. You don't know what's down there. You might have hurt something or woken something up."
Hodor looked at him innocently.
"Hodor?" Far, far, far below, they heard the sound as the stone found water. It wasn't a splash, not truly. It was more a gulp, as if whatever was below had opened a quivering, jellied mouth to swallow Hodor's stone. Faint echoes travelled up the well, and for a moment Bran thought he heard something moving, thrashing about in the water.
"Maybe we shouldn't stay here," he said uneasily. "By the well?" asked Mira. "Or in the night fort?"
"Yes," said Bran. She laughed and sent Hodor out to gather wood. Summer went too. It was almost dark by then, and the dire wolf wanted to hunt. Hodor returned alone with both arms full of dead wood and broken branches. Jojen Reed took his flint and knife and set about lighting a fire, while Mira boned the fish she'd caught at the last stream they'd crossed. Bran wondered how many years had passed since there had last been a supper cooked in the kitchens of the night fort. He wondered who had cooked it, too, though maybe it was better not to know. When the flames were blazing nicely, Mira put the fish on. At least it's not a meat pie. The rat cook had cooked the son of the Andal King in a big pie with onions, carrots, mushrooms, lots of pepper and salt, a rasher of bacon, and a dark red Dornish wine. Then he'd served him to his father, who praised the taste and had a second slice. Afterwards, the guards transformed the cook into a monstrous white rat who could only eat his own young. He had roamed the night fort ever since, devouring his children, but still his hunger was not sated.
"It was not for murder that the gods cursed him," old Nan said, "nor for serving the Andal King his son in a pie. A man has a right to vengeance, but he slew a guest beneath his roof, and that the gods cannot forgive."
"We should sleep," Jojen said solemnly, after they were full. The fire was burning low. He stirred it with a stick.
"Perhaps I'll have another green dream to show us the way."
Hodor was already curled up and snoring lightly. From time to time he thrashed beneath his cloak and whimpered something that might have been Hodor. Bran wriggled closer to the fire. The warmth felt good, and the soft crackling of flames soothed him. But sleep would not come. Outside, the wind was sending armies of dead leaves marching across the courtyards to scratch faintly at the doors and windows. The sounds made him think of old Nan's stories. He could almost hear the ghostly sentinels calling to each other atop the wall and winding their ghostly war horns. Pale moonlight slanted down through the hole in the dome, painting the branches of the weirwood as they strained up toward the roof. It looked as if the tree was trying to catch the moon and drag it down into the well.
"Old gods," Bran prayed, "if you hear me, don't send a dream tonight, or if you do, make it a good dream."
The gods made no answer. Bran made himself close his eyes. Maybe he even slept some, Or maybe he was just drowsing, floating the way you do when you're half awake and half asleep, trying not to think about Mad X or the rat cook or the thing that came in the night. Then he heard the noise. His eyes opened.
What was that?
He held his breath.
Did I dream it? Was I having a stupid nightmare?
He didn't want to wake Mira and Jojen for a bad dream, but
there, a soft scuttling sound, far off. Leaves. It's leaves rattling off the walls outside and rustling together, or the wind. It could be the wind.
The sound wasn't coming from outside, though. Bran felt the hairs on his arm start to rise.
The sound's inside. It's in here, with us. And it's getting louder.
He pushed himself up onto an elbow, listening.
There was wind, and blowing leaves as well, but this was something else. Footsteps. Someone was coming this way. Something was coming this way.
It wasn't the sentinels, he knew. The sentinels never left the wall. But there might be other ghosts in the night fort, ones even more terrible. He remembered what old Nan had said of Mad Axe, how he took his boots off and prowled the castle halls barefoot in the dark, with never a sound to tell you where he was except for the drops of blood that fell from his axe and his elbows and the end of his wet red beard. Or maybe it wasn't Mad Axe at all. Maybe it was the thing that came in the night. The prentice boys all saw it, old Nan said, but afterwards, when they told their Lord Commander, every description had been different.
And three died within a year, and the fourth went mad, and 100 years later, when the thing had come again, the prentice boys were seen shambling along behind it, all in chains.
That was only a story, though. He was just scaring himself. There was no thing that comes in the night. Maester Lewin had said so. If there had ever been such a thing, it was gone from the world now, like giants and dragons.
It's nothing, Bran thought.
But the sounds were louder now.
It's coming from the well,
he realized. That made him even more afraid. Something was coming up from under the ground, coming up out of the dark.
Hodor woke it up. He woke it up with that stupid piece of slate. And now it's coming.
It was hard to hear over Hodor's snores and the thumping of his own heart. Was that the sound blood made, dripping from an axe? Or was it the faint, far-off rattling of ghostly chains? Bran listened harder.
Footsteps.
It was definitely footsteps, each one a little louder than the one before. He couldn't tell how many, though. The well made the sounds echo. He didn't hear any dripping or chains either, but there was something else. A high, thin, whimpering sound, like someone in pain, and heavy, muffled breathing. But the footsteps were loudest. The footsteps were coming closer. Bran was too frightened to shout. The fire had burned down to a few faint embers, and his friends were all asleep. He almost slipped his skin and reached out for his wolf. But summer might be miles away. He couldn't leave his friends helpless in the dark to face whatever was coming up out of the well.
"I told them not to come here," he thought miserably. "I told them there were ghosts. I told them that we should go to Castle Black."
The footfall sounded heavier to Bran, slow, ponderous, scraping against the stone.
"It must be huge."
Mad Axe had been a big man in old Nan's story, and the thing that came in the night had been monstrous. Back in Winterfell, Sansa had told him that the demons of the dark couldn't touch him if he hid beneath his blanket. He almost did that now, before he remembered that he was a prince, and almost a man grown. Bran wriggled across the floor, dragging his dead legs behind him until he could reach out and touch Mira on the foot. She woke at once. He had never known anyone to wake as quickly as Mira Reed, or to be so alert so fast. Bran pressed a finger to his mouth, so she'd know not to speak. She heard the sound at once. He could see that on her face, the echoing footfalls, the faint whimpering, the heavy breathing. Mira rose to her feet without a word and reclaimed her weapons. With her three-pronged frog spear in her right hand and the folds of her net dangling from her left, she slipped barefoot toward the well. Jojen dozed on, oblivious, while Hodor muttered and thrashed in restless sleep. She kept to the shadows as she moved, stepped around the shaft of moonlight as quiet as a cat. Bran was watching her all the while, and even he could barely see the faint sheen of her spear. "I can't let her fight the thing alone," he thought. Summer was far away, but he slipped his skin and reached for Hodor. It was not like sliding into Summer. That was so easy now that Bran hardly thought about it. This was harder, like trying to pull a left boot over your right foot. It fit all wrong, and the boot was scared too. The boot didn't know what was happening. The boot was pushing the foot away. He tasted vomit in the back of Hodor's throat, and that was almost enough to make him flee. Instead, he squirmed and shoved, sat up, gathering his legs under him, his huge, strong legs, and rose. "I'm standing." He took a step. "I'm walking." It was such a strange feeling that he almost fell. He could see himself on the cold stone floor, a little broken thing, but he wasn't broken now. He grabbed Hodor's longsword. The breathing was as loud as a blacksmith's bellows. From the well came a wail, a piercing creech that went through him like a knife. A huge black shape heaved itself up into the darkness and lurched toward the moonlight, and the fear rose up in Bran so thick that before he could even think of drawing Hodor's sword the way he'd meant to, he found himself back on the floor again, with Hodor roaring, "Hodor! Hodor! Hodor!" the way he had in the Lake Tower whenever the lightning flashed. But the thing that came in the night was screaming too, and thrashing wildly in the folds of Mira's net. Bran saw her spear dart out of the darkness to snap at it, and the thing staggered and fell, struggling with the net. The wailing was still coming from the well, even louder now. On the floor, the black thing flopped and fought, screeching, "No! No, don't! Please, don't!" Mira stood over him, the moonlight shining silver off the prongs of her frog spear. "Who are you?" she demanded. "I'm Sam," the black thing sobbed. "Sam! Sam, I'm Sam! Let me out! You stabbed me!" He rolled through the puddle of moonlight, flailing and flopping in the tangles of Mira's net. Hodor was still shouting, "Hodor! Hodor! Hodor!" It was Jojen who fed the sticks to the fire and blew on them until the flames leapt up crackling. Then there was light, and Bran saw the pale, thin-faced girl by the lip of the well, all bundled up in furs and skins beneath an enormous black cloak, trying to shush the screaming baby in her arms. The thing on the floor was pushing an arm through the net to reach his knife, but the loops wouldn't let him. He wasn't any monster beast, or even Mad Axe, drenched in gore. Only a big, fat man dressed up in black wool, black fur, black leather, and black mail. "He's a black brother," said Bran. "Mira, he's from the Night's Watch."
"Hodor!" Hodor squatted down on his haunches to peer at the man in the net. "Hodor!" he said again, hooting.
"The Night's Watch, yes!"
The fat man was still breathing like a bellows.
"I'm a brother of the Watch."
He had one cord under his chins, forcing his head up, and others digging deep into his cheeks.
"I'm a crow. Please let me out of this."
Bran was suddenly uncertain.
"Are you the Three-Eyed Crow?"
"He can't be the Three-Eyed Crow."
I don't think so.
The fat man rolled his eyes, but there were only two of them.
I'm only Sam. Samuel Tarly. Let me out. It's hurting me.
He began to struggle again. Mira made a disgusted sound.
Stop flapping around. If you tear my net, I'll throw you back down the well. Just lie still, and I'll untangle you.
Who are you?
Jojen asked the girl with the baby.
Gilly, she said, for the gillyflower. He's Sam. We never meant to scare you.
She rocked her baby and murmured at it, and finally it stopped crying. Mira was untangling the fat brother. Jojen went to the well and peered down.
Where did you come from?
From Craster's, the girl said. Are you the one?
Jojen turned to look at her.
The one?
He said that Sam wasn't the one, she explained. There was someone else, he said. The one he was sent to find.
Who said?
Bran demanded.
Cold Hands,
Gilly answered softly. Mira peeled back one end of her net, and the fat man managed to sit up. He was shaking, Bran saw, and still struggling to catch his breath.
He said there would be people, he huffed. People in a castle. I didn't know you'd be right at the top of the steps, though. I didn't know you'd throw a net on me or stab me in the stomach.
He touched his belly with a black-gloved hand.
Am I bleeding? I can't see. It was just a poke to get you off your feet, said Mira. Here, let me have a look.
She went to one knee and felt around his navel.
You're wearing mail. I never got near your skin.
Well, it hurt all the same,
Sam complained.
Are you really a brother of the Night's Watch?
Bran asked. The fat man's chin jiggled when he nodded. His skin looked pale and saggy.
Only a steward, I took care of Lord Mormont's ravens.
For a moment he looked like he was going to cry.
I lost them at the fist, though. It was my fault. I got us lost, too. I couldn't even find the wall. It's 100 leagues long and 700 feet high, and I couldn't find it.
Well, you found it now, said Mira. Lift your rump off the ground. I want my net back.
How did you get through the wall?
Jojen demanded as Sam struggled to his feet.
Does the well lead to an underground river? Is that where you came from? You're not even wet.
There's a gate, said Fat Sam, a hidden gate as old as the wall itself. The Black Gate, he called it.
The reeds exchanged a look.
We'll find this gate at the bottom of the well?
Asked Jojen. Sam shook his head.
You won't. I have to take you.
Why?
Mira demanded.
If there's a gate, you won't find it. If you did, it wouldn't open. Not for you. It's the Black Gate.
Sam plucked at the faded black wool of his sleeve.
Only a man of the Night's Watch can open it, he said. A sworn brother who has said his words.
He said,
Jojen frowned,
this Cold Hands?
That wasn't his true name, said Gilly, rocking. We only called him that, Sam and me. His hands were cold as ice, but he saved us from the dead men, him and his ravens, and he brought us here on his elk.
His elk?
Said Bran, wonderstruck.
His elk?
Said Mira, startled.
His ravens?
Said Jojen.
Hodor, said Hodor.
Was he green?
Bran wanted to know.
Did he have antlers?
The fat man was confused.
The elk?
Cold Hands, Bran said impatiently. The green men ride on elks, old Nan used to say. Sometimes they have antlers, too.
He wasn't a green man. He wore blacks, like a brother of the watch, but he was pale as a white, with hands so cold that at first I was afraid. The whites have blue eyes, though, and they don't have tongues, or they've forgotten how to use them.
The fat man turned to Jojen.
He'll be waiting. We should go. Do you have anything warmer to wear? The black gate is cold, and the other side of the wall is even colder. Why didn't he come with you?
Mira gestured toward Gilly and her babe.
They came with you, why not him? Why didn't you bring him through this black gate, too? He can't. Why not? The wall. The wall is more than just ice and stone, he said. There are spells woven into it, old ones and strong. He cannot pass beyond the wall.
It grew very quiet in the castle kitchen then. Bran could hear the soft crackle of the flames, the wind stirring the leaves in the night, the creak of the skinny weirwood reaching for the moon. Beyond the gates, the monsters live, and the giants, and the ghouls, he remembered old Nan saying. But they cannot pass so long as the wall stands strong. So go to sleep, my little Brandon, my baby boy. You needn't fear. There are no monsters here.
I am not the only one you are told to bring, Jojen Reed told Fat Sam in his stained and baggy blacks. He is. Oh, Sam looked down at him uncertainly.
It might have been just then that he realized Bran was crippled.
I'm not strong enough to carry you.
Odor can carry me, Bran pointed at the basket. I ride in that, up on his back.
Sam was staring at him. You're Jon Snow's brother, the one who fell.
No, said Jojen. That boy is dead.
Don't tell, Bran warned. Please.
Sam looked confused for a moment, but finally he said,
I can keep a secret. Gilly, too.
When he looked at her, the girl nodded.
Jon was my brother, too. He was the best friend I ever had. But he went off with Corrin Halfhand to scout the Frostfangs and never came back. We were waiting for him on the Fist when...
John's here, Bran said. Summer saw him. He was with some wildlings, but they killed a man, and John took his horse and escaped. I bet he went to Castle Black. Sam turned big eyes on Mira.
You're certain it was John? You saw him?
I'm Mira, Mira said with a smile.
Summer is...
A shadow detached itself from the broken dome above and leapt down through the moonlight. Even with his injured leg, the wolf landed light and quiet as a snowfall. The girl Gilly made a frightened sound and clutched her babe so hard against her that it began to cry again.
"He won't hurt you," Bran said. "That's Summer." "John said you all had wolves."
Sam pulled off a glove.
"I know, ghost."
He held out a shaky hand, the fingers white and soft and fat as little sausages. Summer padded closer, sniffed them, and gave the hand a lick. That was when Bran made up his mind.
"We'll go with you." "All of you?"
Sam seemed surprised by that. Mira ruffled Bran's hair.
"He's our prince."
Summer circled the well, sniffing. He paused by the top step and looked back at Bran. "He wants to go."
"Will Gilly be safe if I leave her here till I come back?" Sam asked them. "She should be," said Mira. "She's welcome to our fire."
Jojen said,
"The castle is empty."
Gilly looked around.
"Cresta used to tell us tales of castles, but I never knew they'd be so big."
"It's only the kitchens." Bran wondered what she'd think when she saw Winterfell, if she ever did. It took them a few minutes to gather their things and hoist Bran into his wicker seat on Hodor's back. By the time they were ready to go, Gilly sat nursing her babe by the fire.
"You'll come back for me," she said to Sam. "As soon as I can," he promised. "Then we'll go somewhere warm."
When he heard that, part of Bran wondered what he was doing.
"Will I ever go someplace warm again?" "I'll go first. I know the way,"
Sam hesitated at the top. "There's just so many steps," he sighed before he started down. Jojen followed, then Summer, then Hodor with Bran riding on his back. Mira took the rear with her spear and net in hand. It was a long way down. The top of the well was bathed in moonlight, but it grew smaller and dimmer every time they went around. Their footsteps echoed off the damp stones, and the water sounds grew louder.
"Should we have brought torches?" Jojen asked.
"Your eyes will adjust," said Sam. "Keep one hand on the wall, and you won't fall." The well grew darker and colder with every turn. When Bran finally lifted his head around to look back up the shaft, the top of the well was no bigger than a half moon.
"Hodor!" Hodor whispered. "Hodor! Hodor! 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 Hodor!"
The well whispered back. The water sounds were close, but when Bran peered down, he saw only blackness. A turn or two later, Sam stopped suddenly. He was a quarter of the way around the well from Bran and Hodor, and 6 feet farther down, yet Bran could barely see him. He could see the door, though. The Black Gate, Sam had called it. But it wasn't black at all. It was a white weirwood, and there was a face on it. A glow came from the wood, like milk and moonlight, so faint it scarcely seemed to touch anything beyond the door itself, not even Sam standing right before it. The face was old and pale, wrinkled and shrunken. It looks dead. Its mouth was closed, and its eyes. Its cheeks were sunken, its brow withered, its chin sagging.
"If a man could live for 1,000 years and never die but just grow older, his face might come to look like that."
The door opened its eyes. They were white, too, and blind.
"Who are you?" the door asked, and the well whispered, "Who, who, 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 who,
who?" "I am the sword in the darkness," Samuel Tarly said. "I am the watcher on the walls. I am the fire that burns against the cold, the light that brings the dawn, the horn that wakes the sleepers. I am the shield that guards the realms of men."
"Then pass," the door said. Its lips opened, wide, and wider still, until nothing at all remained but a great gaping mouth in a ring of wrinkles. Sam stepped aside and waved Jojen through ahead of him. Summer followed, sniffing as he went, and then it was Bran's turn. Hodor ducked, but not low enough. The door's upper lip brushed softly against the top of Bran's head, and a drop of water fell on him and ran slowly down his nose. It was strangely warm, and salty as a tear.
Daenerys. Meereen was as large as Astabor and Yunkai combined. Like her sister cities, she was built of brick. But where Astabor had been red and Yunkai yellow, Meereen was made with bricks of many colors. Her walls were higher than Yunkai's and in better repair, studded with bastions and anchored by great defensive towers at every angle. Behind them, huge against the sky, could be seen the top of the Great Pyramid, a monstrous thing 800 feet tall with a towering bronze harpy at its top.
"The harpy is a craven thing,"
Dario Naharis said when he saw it.
"She has a woman's heart and a chicken's legs. Small wonder her sons hide behind their walls."
But the hero did not hide. He rode out the city gates, armored in scales of copper and jet, and mounted upon a white charger, whose striped pink and white barding matched the silk cloak flowing from the hero's shoulders. The lance he bore was 14 feet long, swirled in pink and white, and his hair was shaped and teased and lacquered into 2 great curling ram's horns. Back and forth he rode beneath the walls of multicolored bricks, challenging the besiegers to send a champion forth to meet him in single combat. Her blood riders were in such a fever to go meet him that they almost came to blows. "Blood of my blood," Danny told them. "Your place is here by me. This man is a buzzing fly. No more. Ignore him. He will soon be gone." Ego, Jogo, and Ricardo were brave warriors, but they were young and too valuable to risk. They kept her Kalasar together and were her best scouts, too.
"And that was wisely done," Sir Jorah said, as they watched from the front of her pavilion. "Let the fool ride back and forth and shout until his horse goes lame. He does us no harm."
"He does," Austin Whitebeard insisted. "Wards are not won with swords and spears alone, sir. Two hosts of equal strength may come together, but one will break and run, whilst the other stands. This hero builds courage in the hearts of his own men, and plants the seeds of doubt in ours."
Sir Jorah snorted.
"And if our champion were to lose, what sort of seed would that plant? A man who fears battle wins no victory, sir."
"But not speaking of battle, Marine's gates will not open if that fool falls. Why risk a life for naught?
For honour, I would say."
"I've heard enough." Danny did not need their squabbling on top of all the other troubles that plagued her. Marine posed dangers far more serious than one pink and white hero shouting insults, and she could not let herself be distracted. Her host numbered more than 80,000 after Yunkai, but fewer than a quarter of them were soldiers. The rest, well, Sir Jorah called them mouths with feet, and soon they would be starving. The great masters of Marine had withdrawn before Danny's advance, harvesting all they could and burning what they could not harvest. Scorched fields and poison wells had greeted her at every hand. Worst of all, they had nailed a slave child up on every milepost along the coast road from Yunkai. Nailed them up, still living, with their entrails hanging out, and one arm always outstretched to point the way to Marine. Leading her van, Dario had given orders for the children to be taken down before Danny had to see them. But she had countermanded him as soon as she was told. "I will see them," she said. "I will see everyone, and count them, and look upon their faces, and I will remember." By the time they came to Marine, sitting on the salt coast beside her river, the count stood at 163. "I will have this city," Danny pledged to herself once more. The pink and white hero taunted the besiegers for an hour, mocking their manhood, mothers, wives, and gods. Marine's defenders cheered him on from the city walls.
"His name is Uznak Zopal," Bran Ben Plum told her when he arrived for the war council.
He was the new commander of the Second Sons, chosen by a vote of his fellow sellswords.
"I was bodyguard to his uncle once, before I joined the Second Sons, the great masters. What a ripe lot of maggots. The women weren't so bad. That was worth your life to look at the wrong one the wrong way. I knew a man, Scarb. This Uznak cut his liver out. Claimed to be defending a lady's honour, he did. Said Scarb had raped her with his eyes. How'd you rape a wench with eyes, I ask you? But his uncle is the richest man in Marine, and his father commands the city guard, so I had to run like a rat before he killed me, too."
They watched Uznak Zopal dismount his white charger, undo his robes, pull out his manhood, and direct a stream of urine in the general direction of the olive grove, where Danny's gold pavilion stood amongst the burnt trees. He was still pissing when Dario Naharis rode up, arrack in hand.
"Shall I cut that off for you, eh? And stuff it down his mouth, your grace."
His gold tooth shone amidst the blue of his forked beard. "It's his city I want, not his meager manhood." She was growing angry, however. "If I ignore this any longer, my own people will think me weak." Yet who could she send? She needed Dario as much as she did her blood riders. Without the flamboyant Tairoshi, she had no hold on the Stormcrows, many of whom had been followers of Prendelnar Gazin and Salor the Bald. High on the walls of Marine, the jeers had grown louder, and now hundreds of the defenders were taking their lead from the hero and pissing down through the ramparts to show their contempt for the besiegers. "They are pissing on slaves, to show how little they fear us," she thought. "They would never dare such a thing if it were a Dothraki Khalasar outside their gates."
"This challenge must be met," Arstan said again.
"It will be," Danny said, as the hero tucked his penis away again. "Tell Strong Belwas I have need of him." They found the huge brown eunuch sitting in the shade of her pavilion, eating a sausage. He finished it in three bites, wiped his greasy hands clean on his trousers, and sent Arstan Whitebeard to fetch him his steel. The aged squire honed Belwas's arrack every evening and rubbed it down with bright red oil. When Whitebeard brought the sword, Strong Belwas squinted down the edge, grunted, slid the blade back into its leather sheath, and tied the sword belt about his vast waist. Arstan had brought his shield as well, a round steel disc no larger than a pie plate, which the eunuch grasped with his offhand, rather than strapping to his forearm in the manner of Westeros.
"Fine liver and onions, Whitebeard," Belwas said. "Not for now, for after. Killing makes Strong Belwas hungry."
He did not wait for a reply, but lumbered from the olive grove toward Osnag Zopal.
"Why that one, Khaleesi?" Ricaro demanded of her. "He is fat and stupid."
Strong Belwas was a slave here in the fighting pits. If this highborn Osnak should fall to such, the great masters will be shamed. While if he wins, well, it's a poor victory for one so noble, one that Marine can take no pride in. And unlike Ser Jorah, Dario, Bronn Ben, and her three blood riders, the eunuch did not lead troops, plan battles, or give her counsel. He does nothing but eat and boast and bellow at Arstan. Belwas was a man she could most easily spare, and it was time she learned what sort of protector Magister Illyrio had sent her. A thrum of excitement went through the siege lines when Belwas was seen plodding toward the city, and from the walls and towers of Marine came shouts and jeers. Osnag Zopal mounted up again and waited, his striped lance held upright. The charger tossed his head impatiently and pawed the sandy earth. As massive as he was, the eunuch looked small beside the hero and his horse.
"A chivalrous man would dismount," said Arstan.
Osnag Zopal lowered his lance and charged. Belwas stopped, with legs spread wide. In one hand was a small round shield, in the other the curved arrack that Arstan tended with such care. His great bronze stomach and sagging chest were bare above the yellow silk sash knotted about his waist, and he wore no armor but his studded leather vest, so absurdly small that he did not even cover his nipples. "We should have given him chainmail," Danny said, suddenly anxious.
"Mail would only slow him," said Ser Jorah. "They wear no armor in the fighting pits. It's blood the crowds come to see."
Dust flew from the hooves of the white charger. Osnak thundered towards Strong Belwas, his striped cloak streaming from his shoulders. The whole city of Marine seemed to be screaming him on. The besiegers' cheer seemed few and thin by comparison. Her unsullied stood in silent ranks, watching with stone faces. Belwas might have been made of stone as well. He stood in the horse's path, his vest stretched tight across his broad back. Osnak's lance was leveled at the center of his chest. Its bright steel point winked in the sunlight. "He's going to be impaled," she thought, as the eunuch spun sideways, and quick as the blink of an eye, the horseman was beyond him, wheeling, raising the lance. Belwas made no move to strike at him. The Miranese on the wall screamed even louder.
"What is he doing?" Danny demanded.
"Giving the mob a show," Ser Jorah said.
Osnak brought the horse around Belwas in a wide circle, then dug in with his spurs and charged again. Again Belwas waited, then spun and knocked the point of the lance aside. She could hear the eunuch's booming laughter echoing across the plain as the hero went past him.
"The lance is too long," Sir Jorah said. "All Belwas needs do is avoid the point. Instead of trying to spit him so prettily, the fool should ride right over him."
Osnek's opal charged a third time, and now Danny could see plainly that he was riding past Belwas, the way a Westerosi knight might ride at an opponent in a tilt, rather than at him, like a Dothraki riding down a foe. The flat level ground allowed the charger to get up a good speed, but it also made it easy for the eunuch to dodge the cumbersome 14-foot lance. Marine's pink and white hero tried to anticipate this time, and swung his lance sideways at the last second, to catch Strong Belwas when he dodged, but the eunuch had anticipated too, and this time he dropped down instead of spinning sideways. The lance passed harmlessly over his head, and suddenly Belwas was rolling, and bringing the razor-sharp Arrak around in a silver arc. They heard the charger scream as the blade bit into his legs, and then the horse was falling, the hero tumbling from the saddle. A sudden silence swept along the brick parapets of Marine. Now it was Danny's people who were screaming and cheering. Osnak leapt clear of his horse and managed to draw his sword before Strong Belwas was on him. Steel sang against steel, too fast and furious for Danny to follow the blows. It could not have been a dozen heartbeats before Belwas's chest was awash in blood from a slice below his breast, and Osnak Zopal had an Arrak planted right between his ram's horns. The eunuch wrenched the blade loose and parted the hero's head from his body with three savage blows to the neck. He held it up high for the Marinese to see, then flung it toward the city gates and let it bounce and roll across the sand.
"So much for the hero of Marine," said Dario, laughing.
"A victory without meaning," Sir Jorah cautioned. "We will not win Marine by killing its defenders one at a time."
"No," Danny agreed, "but I'm pleased we killed this one." The defenders on the walls began firing their crossbows at Belwas, but the bolts fell short or skittered harmlessly along the ground. The eunuch turned his back on the steel-tipped rein, lowered his trousers, squatted, and shat in the direction of the city. He wiped himself with Osnak's striped cloak and paused long enough to loot the hero's corpse and put the dying horse out of its agony before trudging back to the olive grove. The besiegers gave him a raucous welcome as soon as he reached the camp. A Dothraki hooted and screamed, and the Unsullied sent up a great clangor by banging their spears against their shields.
"Well done," Sir Jorah told him,
and Bran Ben tossed the eunuch a ripe plum and said, "A sweet fruit for a sweet fight." Even her Dothraki handmaids had words of praise.
"We would braid your hair and hang a bell in it, Strong Belwas," said Jiqui, "but you have no hair to braid."
"Strong Belwas, nage no kinkly bells."
The eunuch ate Bran Ben's plum in four big bites and tossed aside the stone.
"Strong Belwas needs liver and onions."
"You shall have it," said Danny. "Strong Belwas is hurt." His stomach was red with the blood sheeting down from the meaty gash beneath his breasts.
"It is nothing. I let each man cut me once before I kill him."
He slapped his bloody belly.
"Count the cuts, and you will know how many Strong Belwas has slain."
But Danny had lost Khal Drogo to a similar wound, and she was not willing to let it go untreated. She sent Missandei to find a certain Yunkish freedman renowned for his skill in the healing arts. Belwas howled and complained, but Danny scolded him and called him a big bald baby until he let the healer staunch the wound with vinegar, sew it shut, and bind his chest with strips of linen soaked in fire wine. Only then did she lead her captains and commanders inside her pavilion for their council. "I must have this city," she told them, sitting cross-legged on a pile of cushions, her dragons all about her. Irian Jiqui poured wine. "Her granaries are full to bursting. There are figs and dates and olives growing on the terraces of her pyramids, and casks of salt fish and smoke meat buried in her cellars.
And a fat chest of gold, silver, and gemstones as well,
Dario reminded them.
Let us not forget the gemstones.
I've had a look at the landward walls, and I see no point of weakness, said Sir Jorah Mormont. Given time, we might be able to mine beneath a tower and make a breach, but what do we eat while we're digging? Our stores are all but exhausted.
No weakness in the landward walls, said Danny. Marine stood on a jut of sand and stone, where the slow brown Skahazadan flowed into Slaver's Bay. The city's north wall ran along the riverbank, its west along the bay shore. Does that mean we might attack from the river or the sea?
With three ships. We'll want to have Captain Grolio take a good look at the wall along the river, but unless it's crumbling, that's just a wetter way to die.
What if we were to build siege towers? My brother Viserys told tales of such. I know they can be made.
From ward, Your Grace, Sir Jorah said. The slavers have burnt every tree within 20 leagues of here. Without wood, we have no trebuchets to smash the walls, no ladders to go over them, no siege towers, no turtles, and no rams. We can storm the gates with axes, to be sure, but...
Did you see them bronze heads above the gates? Asked Bran Ben Plum. Rows of harpy heads with open mouths. The Meronese can squirt boiling oil out of their mouths and cook your axemen where they stand.
Dario Naharis gave Grey Worm a smile.
Perhaps the Unsullied should wield their axes. Boiling oil feels like no more than a warm bath to you, I have heard.
This is false.
Grey Worm did not return the smile.
These ones do not feel burns as men do, yet such oil blinds and kills. The Unsullied do not fear to die, though. Give these ones rams, and we will batter down these gates or die in the attempt.
You would die, said Bran Ben. At Yunkai, when he took command of the Second Sons, he claimed to be the veteran of 100 battles. Though I will not say I fought bravely in all of them. There are old sellswords and bold sellswords, but no old bold sellswords. She saw that it was true. Danny sighed. I will not throw away unsolid lives, Grey Worm. Perhaps we can starve the city out. Sir Jorah looked unhappy.
We'll starve long before they do, Your Grace. There's no food here, no fodder for our mules and horses. I do not like this river water either. Marine shits into the Skahazadan, but draws its drinking water from deep wells. Already we've had reports of sickness in the camps, fever and brown leg, and 3 cases of the bloody flux. There will be more if we remain. The slaves are weak from the march.
Freedmen, Danny corrected. They are slaves no longer.
Slave or free, they are hungry and they'll soon be sick. The city is better provisioned than we are, and can be resupplied by water. Your 3 ships are not enough to deny them access to both the river and the sea.
Then what do you advise, Sir Jorah?
You will not like it.
I would hear it all the same.
As you wish. I say, let this city be. You cannot free every slave in the world, Khaleesi. Your war is in Westeros.
I have not forgotten Westeros. Danny dreamt of it some nights, this fabled land that she had never seen. If I let Marine's old brick walls defeat me so easily, though, how will I ever take the great stone castles of Westeros?
As Aegon did, Sir Jorah said, with fire. By the time we reach the 7 Kingdoms, your dragons will be grown, and we will have siege towers and trebuchets as well, all the things we lack here. But the way across the lands of the Long Summer is long and grueling, and there are dangers we cannot know. You stopped at Astapor to buy an army, not to start a war. Save your spears and swords for the 7 Kingdoms, my queen. Leave Marine to the Myrinese, and march west for Pentos.
Defeated, said Danny, bristling.
When cowards hide behind great walls, it is they who are defeated, Khaleesi, Khojoga said.
Her other blood riders concurred.
"Blood of my blood," said Ricardo,